The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We want to make sure that we are moving quickly. I've gotten some ransomware notes that just have a long runway, so they allow you a few days to think about things. I've had some that have given, you know, a day, maybe less, with threats on the back end. So if you do not respond within a day, we'll start calling up your family members. So that happens. We will text your wife. Stuff like that, that gets really personal and increases the pressure.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 29th, 2024. Shannon Tagawa Mercer served as Lawfare's managing editor and then went on to quite a career shift. She now negotiates with ransomware malactors. She is a cybersecurity and privacy lawyer at WilmerHale and has developed a specialized practice in responding to cybersecurity incidents, many of them involving foreign malware gangs. She joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about this odd area of legal practice. Why do you need a big law firm when your computer files are suddenly frozen? Is it legal to negotiate with and pay off foreign ransomware gangs? How do you do the negotiations anyway? Do they cut you a deal if you're polite? And what is it like to be recruited by the malware gangs that you are negotiating with? It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 29th. Shannon Tagawa Mercer on negotiating with the bad guys. Hey folks, just a programming note here that Shannon is speaking in her personal capacity in this conversation, and her comments should not be attributed to any of her clients or to the law firm of WilmerHale. Most Lawfare readers and listeners, if they know the name Shannon Tagawa Mercer, know it because you used to be associated with Lawfare, and you have even hosted one, two, or three episodes of the Lawfare podcast, as well as written stuff on the site.
That's right.
But these days, you have a different job, and I want to start by just having you describe what you do for a living.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me first. It's nice to be back in the Lawfare orbit. I've missed this. What I do for a living is probably not what you'd expect the traditional Lawfare alum to go on and do, but definitely sort of building off of what we explored and discussed in our work. I am a cybersecurity and privacy attorney with WilmerHale. I'm a counsel at the WilmerHale DC office.
So that actually, that doesn't sound that exotic or that improbable for a former Lawfare person. In fact, if you'd said, like, what's the classic trajectory, somebody might have said, you know, you work at Lawfare for a couple of years and then you become a cybersecurity and privacy attorney.
I'm getting there. It's what's underneath the hood that's really interesting. So I did start off as a more traditional privacy attorney, loved the work that we did when I was at Lawfare, looking into all of the various privacy considerations on the government side and the private sector side. And when I started working, there was a lot of interesting work in a different space, which was not unrelated, which is incident response. And so from a law firm, when you think about sort of lawyers in their suits going to, you know, their offices in K Street, you don't necessarily think about them getting into sort of the nitty-gritty of incident response with cyber criminals and threat actors across borders and export controlled data. But the truth is, in our field, we do a lot of that. And that's a lot of my work now. So in the cybersecurity space, I spend a significant amount of time working with our clients on ransomware and cyber extortion matters, and often end up working with them from day one when they get a ransom note. And we need to talk to cyber threat negotiators and coordinate with law enforcement. And we are on the ground running with them, sort of in the weeds, looking at these ransomware negotiations, helping them with strategy, at the same time as sort of helping them figure out what to do about the incident, determine the impact. So it's really quite hands-on. A lot of it is legal work, but a lot of it is also crisis management, strategic matters, communications, and all of that good stuff. Maybe you're right. Maybe that is what you train us to do, Ben, at Lawfare.
No. So as far as I know, you are the only Lawfare alum who negotiates with cyber criminals.
I'm the only one who tells you about it.
Right. Well, that's what I said, as far as I know. So I want to focus on the word incident. Mm-hmm. So you say incident response, and this is one of those clinical words, like an incident sounds like, you know, a fender bender or something. But when you use the word incident, what type of thing are we talking about, and it has happened to whom?
Yeah, so you're sort of homing in on a really important point, which is what kind of activity happens and how do you need to respond to it? So the word incident can be defined differently in a lot of different contexts. So not only are we thinking about, you know, what regulatory obligations kick in when a certain definition has been met, especially in the case of data breaches or unauthorized access or acquisition of data, but we're also thinking about how companies are operating and managing their cyber threat risk profiles and how they're managing their incident response plans or processes. When it comes to us getting involved, and when it comes to the type of work that you just mentioned I do, most of the time, you know it when you see it. So you're going to get a ransom note. You're going to get communications from a ransomware threat actor. That isn't to say in all cases that that ransom note, the communication from the threat actor, the posting on a name and shame site on the dark web actually does mean you've been victimized. But it's a pretty good sign that you need to start working through your incident response plan to figure out what's going on. An incident usually isn't something like, you know, we think that we've found a malicious executable on, you know, our system, but we stopped it and we're, you know, getting rid of it and cleaning things up. An incident is when you have sort of an active intrusion or a past intrusion that's caused sort of damage, data leakage, data access or acquisition, as I mentioned, exposure, data breaches. Or, and again, this is another you know it when you see it type of moment, your systems are down and they've been encrypted. And that's certainly in the incident camp. Unfortunately for, you know, many clients who are dealing with that, that ends up happening, you know, very quickly in a way that needs to be unraveled carefully. And you're handling sort of that, which might require business, sort of an estimate of business impact. At the same time, you're trying to figure out how to get out of it. So you're figuring out what to do with the threat actor, whether the threat actor's decryptors are actually going to work, whether you can rebuild the systems yourselves, how many backups you have, are they reliable, where are they, are they safe, are they clean, can you get the system back up, and all those types of questions.
So for purposes of this conversation, let's focus on ransomware incidents. Mm-hmm. What percentage of the incident response that you work on these days involves ransomware?
My non-scientific estimate is probably 80%. When you say ransomware, I want to be clear. There's sort of two things going on, and one thing is happening more than the other now. There's ransomware in the traditional sense. So a ransom gang has encrypted your systems.
We freeze your encrypt your systems, mm-hmm. Give us 500 bitcoins, and we'll give you the keys to decrypt.
Yep, exactly. That's the traditional ransomware. And then there's cyber extortion, which is a method that cyber gangs or ransomware gangs use now in increasing volume, which is get into the system, grab what they can, get out of the system and then tell you what they have and threaten you with it, which has a few advantages from their perspective.
I mean, it seems like the big advantage is they get to bill you twice, right? Once for decrypting your systems and then the other for selling you your information back.
Yeah. So on the encryption side, that's right. There are lots of different angles and leverage that these gangs have. So on one hand, they can say, we know you need this system. It's fundamental to your business. We've taken your website down. Like, you can't do, you know, your points of sale are down. You can't operate. And so we know that this is valuable to you and the clock is ticking. It gets more valuable over time. The other advantage, of course, you're right, is that every company knows if, for instance, they could have had access to data, whether it's IP or personal data or PII or PHI, that's already valuable to you because you already have regulatory responsibilities, very likely, that you're going to need to figure out and pay for, and you're coming up against other timelines. So they have two points of leverage for you in that space. The downside to the encryption methods are that, you know, sometimes companies will realize very quickly that you didn't get access to sensitive data and maybe you encrypted a portion of the network that can be rebuilt really quickly, or the backups actually can be stood up. I mean, that's not, I wouldn't say that's common, but it's a possibility. So there's that. On the data extortion side of things, obviously, they can still make quite a bit of money without going through the whole sort of song and dance of encrypting your system by extorting you for the data they have, threatening to leak it on the dark web. They can sell it or resell it and all those types of things.
So, you know, just to give a sense of volume, how many of these ransomware cyber extortion cases have you handled? Is this a, like, 3 to 5? Is it 300 to 500? What's, like, how often does your phone ring and, you know, it's a Wilmer client who's, or a would-be Wilmer client whose systems are encrypted?
Yeah. So we're not dealing in the sort of huge volumes of small attacks. It's sort of hard to, I don't think a number in that space would be meaningful, because of course these things aren't happening on some sort of rhythm or pattern. This is not, you know, the sort of standard business email compromise type of breach that you might see, you know, you might say is more run of the mill. But we handle a number of large incidents over the course of the year, whether they're existing clients or new clients. And so again, I don't think a number is meaningful, but I do think this sort of magnitude of incident we're talking about is sort of the stuff where, you know, clients really need our specialized advice.
So people don't bring in Wilmer to deal with like piddly shit email compromise stuff. If you guys are like, that's, you guys are like the cavalry coming in with, if there's a major company has a, you know, a business debilitating takedown.
So yes, that's absolutely true. I will say that if an existing client or really anyone who really needs our services for any type of incident, and I have dealt with small business email compromises on a few occasions, we'll handle it, of course. But that's right. I think that unfortunately, cybercrime is proliferated in such a way that there are lots of different flavors of incidents. And there are some incidents that can be handled in ways that have been sort of templatized or standardized in some cases because they're really common. And then there are some incidents that are really uncommon. And
the bespoke incident problem.
Yeah. And they're bespoke for a lot of different reasons, right? And it's the confluence of different elements or facts about the incident. So in some cases, it's the type of data that was compromised, the importance or the size of the company, the threat actor itself, right? Are they, you know, a threat actor where we're thinking this might be a sanctioned entity, or have individuals who are sanctioned who are in this gang working right now, or is it not? You know, what they're asking for. Sometimes you can get, you know, really, really bizarre types of communications that don't follow normal patterns. And so you can't just sort of plug and play your normal response process to that kind of incident.
Right. So let's talk about, I was going to say what a typical incident looks like, but you're saying you guys tend to be brought in the non-typical incidents. Are these situations where you principally end up negotiating with the threat actor, or are these situations in which the goal is to get law enforcement to neutralize the threat actor? What is the objective here when Shannon Togawa Mercer lands on the beachhead and tries to take the island. What's the strategic objective?
So it's different for every client, but it's exactly the right question, and we ask it very quickly. And it depends on largely what was impacted. So what data might have been accessed or acquired, what systems are down, and what the client's risk appetite is. And then it also depends on the threat actor. So to answer your question more directly, there's no one answer, but the answer is always you need to have a goal at the outset. And part of the reason is because some of how you handle the incident will turn on what you're trying to, all of it will turn on what you're trying to get at. So we almost certainly always try to make sure that we get the information we need to get from the threat actor to determine what's going on. And sometimes when you negotiate with a threat actor, you are thinking, this is really important. I need to get these decryptors. I'm going to pay. And that's just it. That's a very complicated decision that businesses need to handle as is appropriate for them, considering all their legal obligations. Sometimes you don't know what's going on. You don't know what they have. You don't know if they're telling the truth. We've had a lot of situations where it becomes very clear they're not telling the truth to begin with. And what you're looking for is time. And so often, and we're not the ones, just to clarify in case anyone had any misunderstandings, we're not the ones with our hands on keys typing to these threat actors in our Onion browsers, on their threat actor website.
So you've never actually talked to like APT3 yourself, hi, it's Shannon. You're asking too much for decryption here. Can you cut me a break? That's never you who's having that conversation.
So we're never the ones doing the typing. We are, however, intimately involved in crafting the message. So the people who are doing the typing are often third, but there's a whole group of companies who are experts in this. Many of them former law enforcement who go into the business of helping you execute on the goal with the threat actor. And they will be the ones who go into the dark web, open up the chat. They'll be the ones who engage in, your proton mail exchange for other types of threat actors and do the typing. They will advise on the messages. And some of them have most of them have really in-depth knowledge about how these threat actors work because they do this across a lot of companies. But we are also helping the client craft the message. And usually we'll have a significant input in what gets typed. So we're looking at transcripts. We're getting these in real time. We're talking to the threat intel company or the ransomware negotiator about what they know, what they think is going to happen next based on patterns. Many of them have data about how long it'll take these threat actors to respond, whether or not the threat actors work on the weekends. There are some ransomware gangs that take the weekends off, believe it or not.
Yes, I want to get to the culture of the ransomware gangs in a minute. That stuff is really interesting. But I'm trying to isolate here your role, and you're saying there's always a layer of distance between you and the people who are actually doing the negotiation.
That's right. Yeah, we're so we play a lot of roles in these scenarios. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of the things that we do are providing legal advice, but in some cases, because our clients have not experienced an incident like this before, we're road mapping what needs to happen next. We're liaising with law enforcement or other government agencies on behalf of the client. We're managing the threat actor or the threat intel firm or the ransomware negotiation firm, as well as the forensics firms. We're making sure that the information that we're garnering on both sides is feeding that other portion of the work stream. So for instance, and this is something I'm sure we'll get into in a second, but when you think about responding to a ransomware incident, your forensics will inform what you're negotiating with. So what leverage you have, can you actually prove internally what they have access to, what they've done, can you not? And your ransomware conversation with the gang will inform your forensics. So if the gang is telling you we have X, Y, and Z, you need to go back to your forensics firm or the in-house forensics team in who's working with the forensics firm and say, we actually think this might be where you want to look. Or have you been able to validate that? Because they're saying this. And if you can validate that, then what about that? And there's just a real tight cooperation there that we have to help facilitate. Obviously, we are advising our client on, their response process and helping them with their legal obligations. But we have a lot of perspective on how things have gone in the past and try to make sure that we use that in sort of a crisis management way too. So with the threat intel firms and the ransomware negotiation firms, what they bring to the table is experience with the threat actors across a lot of different companies over time. Many of them will say something like, oh, this gang hasn't identified themselves yet, but we've done a speech pattern recognition test across our database, and we think they're related to this gang that disbanded last year. So they might be like the new version of this gang. And the gang that you're dealing with now is new, but the gang last year, if it is the same gang, you know, settled on a 75% ransom decrease at the end of the day after, you know, X number of weeks of negotiation. We don't have those stats, Ben. that's not something we have across a lot of companies. Now, we do obviously bring to bear our knowledge from other incidents to the extent we can and can disclose information in an abstract way, but that's what those firms do. They also obviously have access to the dark web. They're comfortable, you know, they have sandboxes that they need to use for certain things. They're comfortable downloading the data that's shared. They know how to use ransomware gang language. Like, they know how to speak in sort of casual ways. They know when to be brusque, when not to be brusque, when to be threatening, when to be kind or solicitous. And then they also have a lot of other things under the hood that they use. I think they cultivate a lot of threat intel gathering on the dark web. So they, you know, obviously it's their business to know more about these gangs. So they do lots of things I have no insight into and to get more information from the people who are doing these terrible things. So that's the role they play.
Yeah. So let's talk about what the team looks like. So you have, so your phone rings in the middle of the night and it's company X whose systems are encrypted and believes that a lot of information may have been exfiltrated and they have a ransom note. And so you bring in a threat intelligence company, you bring in, you have you and your crew of lawyers, and you have presumably a technical cybersecurity firm, right?
Yep.
And you have a ransomware negotiator, that firm that is going to be separate from those two. Who else are you bringing in? Who else is on like team good guys?
So team good
very
guys.
Very expensive. Very expensive good guys, I want to add.
It's no comment. So the team is obviously the internal resources that exist at a company, which vary. So some companies have robust cybersecurity groups and cyber incident response teams, and some don't. The legal team at the company, of course, including whoever's in charge of cybersecurity on the legal team, but also privacy. Often the incident response, when you don't know what's impacted, will start by providing transparency to both until one, namely the privacy one, could be ruled out. It depends on what was impacted. There's us. So on our side, it would be the cyber privacy experts in our team. There is a forensics firm. So usually we will engage on behalf of our client a leading forensics firm to assist in the investigation of what was impacted and potentially the remediation of any issues. And they'll work hand in hand with the incident response team in-house or the you know, IT team, whichever team is sort of leading the response technically. And they are usually separate from the threat intel and ransomware negotiation group, which is often one firm because they're gathering their intel through their negotiation activities. Those people will come in, often even before a decision has been made to engage a ransomware actor, just to provide more information about who these entities might be and what we expect them to do. So they'll come in early, very, very early. And then if we determine we want to engage with the threat actor, they'll be the ones executing on that. Some companies need to augment their external communications or crisis communications capabilities. And so sometimes we'll bring in a crisis communication firm to help structure the incident response communications. You're probably getting the sense from everything that I'm saying, but incident response feels a lot like sort of the first couple weeks can sometimes feel like you're in the fog of war. Like there's a crisis management really does mean helping people see through that. And so bringing these teams in can seem a bit chaotic, but the truth is every single one of these teams has been through so many of these situations that they can plug in pretty well. Of course, we, you know, try to make sure that there's a clear leader, a clear project manager, whether that's us or someone in-house at the company, often in-house counsel. But those are the teams. I wouldn't say crisis communications comes in a lot. It really depends on how big the incident is and what you're thinking is going to happen down the road, and then how capable your in-house team is.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
All right, so it's the middle of the night, and your phone rings, and it is the general counsel of Company X who says, we have a situation. Our X, Y, and Z systems are all down, and we've gotten this note with a scary-looking cat with a red nose, and it's demanding that we pay, you know, a gazillion dollars in unmarked Bitcoin and put it in a hollow tree. What are the first things that you do?
So the first thing is, of course, get on the phone with the client and understand what's happening from a forensic perspective. So make sure that we know what they know about what's going on. I think the cardinal rule for anyone in this practice area is forensics are first. If you're saying the systems are down, of course, there are some obvious consequences there that aren't going to be missed by the forensics team. But really understanding where we think this is coming from is important because we need to gather as much information as possible in order to inform next steps. So that's one thing. That will also include an assessment of the general category of what might be impacted, which could include the data that was accessible within the encrypted systems. And so understanding that is important. You know, some clients we understand very well because we work with them frequently, and so we'll have our own ideas about what could have been impacted. But for newer clients, it's obviously a really quick learn, or you need to get up to speed very quickly on what they do, what their crown jewels are, what they're trying to protect, and what they think might be compromised. The second question, of course, is to make sure they have the right people in the room. So most companies will have an incident response plan in place that they'll test and train on. They'll do tabletop exercises over the course of the year, and that will include making sure the teams who know what their responsibilities are practicing them, and there will be a hierarchy, and there will be an assessment of impact and severity rankings and those types of things. We will often either have that or ask for it and then make sure all of the right people are being communicated with, including in that first moment, that we have the right people from forensics, from the cybersecurity org, from the IT org, from the legal org in the room. At that stage, in that first moment, it's possible that you're only a few minutes in and, you know, the executive leadership doesn't know. So you need to figure out sort of where everyone is on the field. And then you need to figure out, okay, in addition to the people we have in the room, who else do we need? So do we need a third-party forensics firm? Do you have one already on retainer, which we advise our clients to have in place? If not, let's get them now. Let's get them on the phone. And more often than not, we have worked with so many different forensics firms. It's like me texting, you know, random guy from forensics firm X, and he's like, I'm on the beach in Hawaii, go call this person. And, you know, us sort of working our network to get the person online if it's, you know, midnight or 1 a.m. or whenever it is. Then we also, of course, if there's a ransomware note involved, ask if they have a negotiator. And if they don't have a negotiator, we find one for them. We get the negotiator on the phone and say, this is the note. Tell us about it, right? Who do you think these guys are? If they haven't said who they are already, how do we engage? What's their track record? What do we do? And then we think about reporting to law enforcement. So the FBI has an incredible network of field offices that handle these threat actors across the country. There are recommended ways to report through their IC3 portal. But then you also, especially if it's a severe incident, want to think about getting in touch with the FBI in that field office, your local field office, and talking to them about what's going on. More often than not, we'll be the ones doing that because, of course, the client has more important things to focus on. And we want to make sure that they're not sort of juggling that communication at the same time. But getting in touch with the field office. The field office will sometimes have very good information, right? Sometimes they'll see that this is like a pattern, something that's popped up over the last couple of days. They understand who's being victimized. Sometimes they'll have to refer you to a different field office that's handling the threat actor. But more often than not, reporting to them is a good idea. Once we have all of that in place, We want to make sure that we are moving quickly. I've gotten some ransomware notes that just have a long runway, so they allow you a few days to think about things. I've had some that have given, you know, a day, maybe less, with threats on the back end. So if you do not respond within a day, we'll start calling up your family members. So that happens. We will text your wife. Stuff like that, that gets really personal and increases the pressure.
But hang on a second. Call your family members, text your wife implies that there's something other than a frozen system. Or, I mean, if you called most people's wives and said your husband's business computers are encrypted, she would say, why are you telling me this? I assume these are extortion situations.
So yes, in extortion situations, they try to up the pressure there. But there are also, you get a sort of variety of responses or a variety of engagement types from these actors. So if a system is down, you know, it could be they don't know what they have, or they, you know, they've only been able to encrypt a portion of something. And so there's a lot of different methods that they can use to sort of push on you to respond and engage and create that sense of urgency. It's oftentimes, I mean, it's a bit like social engineering, right? If you create a sense of urgency, then like someone might act in the way you want them to act, or they have less control than you do. But that's part of our role, is to make sure that, you know, everyone is sort of being level-headed and planful about what to do next. And so moving quickly doesn't necessarily mean getting on, you know, on the talks channel with the threat actor right now. What it means is, are we talking to the right people internally? How much longer is it going to take us to assess damage? If your systems are down and they're going to, like, that downtime is going to impact your commercials, if it's going to impact how much product you can put out the door, or how you can interact with clients or consumers, you know, how are you estimating that damage? What's our backup? The steps of an incident don't really change depending on, you know, in terms of sort of whether you're dealing with a ransomware actor or not. The first most important thing is containment. So you're going to be, again, forensics are first, but is the attack contained is really the primary question. And as lawyers, we sort of take a do not harm. I mean, my practice, we take a do not harm approach, right? We don't want to get in the way of that. So obviously there are all these other considerations, but we want to make sure containment is being achieved. And if it's not being achieved, we're understanding why it's not being achieved. At the same time, we handle, you know, outside of that, when the technical teams are working on that, we try to handle these other threads that I just mentioned. Of course, the next step and the next thing to consider is remediation, but sometimes that can be long-term. If you're dealing with systems that are down and encrypted, the remediation question is fundamental. Do we need these decryptors to remediate? Can we bring these systems up ourselves? What's the integrity of our backups? Always important in that step to make the clients aware of this unfortunate fact that even when you get decryptors from threat actors, they don't always work, or they don't always work really well. So like, there are lots of people who think if they've never been through one of these situations that you can just press a button, like, I'm going to pay 3 million Bitcoin and then suddenly everything's going to be okay. And the truth is, you pay 3 million Bitcoin, you know, get your decryptors, and then there are just weeks sometimes of working through each system, making sure that there's data integrity. Systems don't come up sometimes, and so it's quite messy. So there's weighing that too.
So do the gangs give a refund if their decryptors don't work?
Oh, Ben, if only. If only.
Because I think they should warranty their work. All right, let's talk a little bit about the culture of these gangs.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the common wisdom is that they are basically Russian gangs. True or false?
Not all of them. No, definitely not all of them.
What are the big ransomware, like the top five ransomware countries in Shana Tagawa Mercer practice experience?
So first of all, they're all over the world. And I've dealt with a lot of Eastern, sort of vaguely ambiguously Eastern European groups that may not actually be Russian or may not be clearly tied to sanctioned individuals. And so there's that ambiguity in there is really where the legal analysis comes in.
Right. So you get the accent, but you're not sure, is it Russian or Serbian?
It's not. Where in Moldova is that thing?
Right. Is it in Transnistria or is it in Romanian speaking Moldova? Yeah, it's a hard problem.
It's incredibly, and sometimes it's really hard to tell. But so like if you have a gang that identifies itself, obviously, then all of the information the world's collected about this gang you can bring to bear, right? And there the FBI and CISA have put out a lot of information about these gangs to the extent they know it. When they don't identify themselves, that's when it gets tricky because we start to do a lot of, I want to say that I personally start to look at words, how they're spelled, how grammar, you know, what the grammar is in the notes.
Are there articles in front of the nouns or not?
Yeah. Yeah. Is that spelled in a British way? That was one. I had a very long conversation internally about that once, which I at one point realized was useless. But I was like, there are O's and U's next to each other in here. I'm thinking all sorts of different locations. Yeah. So I'd say, you know, in my experience, I've had a lot of sort of vaguely Eastern European gangs, not clearly sanctioned. But these networks are so distributed. They could be all over the place, right? Like, I think it wasn't there a recent conviction of one of the Lockbit actors who's Canadian, convicted in Canada? There's so much distribution and there's so much reconstitution of them too. So it's not just, you know, where they're located. They're not sort of a stagnant thing. These groups form, they, you know, hit a bunch of companies and they might, you know, there might be infighting or they might get disbanded by various law enforcement activities, or they might just decide, you know, this has run its course, let's go elsewhere. And then they reconstitute themselves in different forms, sometimes with different attitudes, different personalities.
So like when we say gang, people's minds immediately go to sort of urban street gangs, right, which involve fairly large numbers of people, you know, and some of them are transnational and they're big. How many people is in a cyber ransomware gang? Is that like 200? Are these like big companies? How big is one?
Yeah. So, you know, I've experienced a range. I will say that I've had at least one incident where a threat actor represented itself as a large company. And like when I say large company, what I mean is it represented itself as an organization. It turned out it was probably just one person and one person, you know, speaking in a few different voices and being quite creative. And then there are these large distributed networks, these huge networks of individuals who are, again, as I mentioned, not in the same place, right? They're communicating via different channels. When you say organization, that could be generous. But when we do deal with these bigger groups, I'm sometimes surprised at how structured they are. So like the groups that have often these name and shame sites, for instance, have, you know, infrastructure. So they have websites with chat, like chat processes, expectations. I mean, I've seen at least one with like a little note that says, you know, we're not around 24 hours a day. So please, you know, apologies for any inconvenience if we don't respond immediately. Things like some very corporate sort of items in these places. And then when you're chatting, and I think this is, I mean, many times I think it's a negotiation tactic, but it's quite interesting to see. You'll be chatting with someone and then they'll have to escalate something to their manager. And then something, the manager will come in and there will be sort of a different tone. It's unclear, of course, if it's truly a different person, but the suggestion that there's a hierarchy and a structure and a protocol is really fascinating.
Yeah. So, I mean, this idea that it's kind of like, you know, like a customer service line, you know, where, you know, hi, I'll be your ransomware robber today.
Mm-hmm. You know, how may I help you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what is the tone of the interactions like? Is it, you know, it's not personal, it's just business? Is it like, are they trying to be friendly? What, when you deal with like a ransomware gang, is it pleasant and businesslike? Is it threatening?
So I will say most of the exchanges I've seen have been very transactional. So very businesslike. I mean, pleasant is a sort of hard evaluation to make in these scenarios. Even if they're using sort of corporate niceties, it's obviously not a pleasant scenario. But the very transactional, really sort of to the point, sort of like a regular business negotiation. You know, here's what we have, here's what we want. What's your response? Some can get personal. And so I've been fortunate to not be in the scenario where I've dealt with a threat actor who has been, you know, truly offensive. But I have heard and read stories about those who can get quite personal and offensive. The tone of the negotiation will change depending on whether you're giving them what they want. It's almost certainly true in most of these engagements where there will be more threats in sort of the, you know, what I think of as sort of the peak of the negotiation. If you decide that you are going to pay, or if you're making an offer to pay to see if that can get you more information, and then you don't and you stall a bit, or you're playing for time, there will be a lot of frustration and a lot of expression of that frustration. You know, you're just playing me. I don't think you actually intend to pay. More often than not, these gangs will start out with a message that sort of suggests to you the trouble you're in. So we have X terabytes of your data. You know, we think it's from, you know, X geographies, or it's this type of sensitive data. You know that you now have obligations based on GDPR and obligations based on state data breach laws, and you're going to have to report to HHS, and you don't want to have to do that, do you? As if that's sort of, as if there's actually a legal out in that exchange. So there's some of that, some sort of an understanding of the considerations and an expression of the considerations. The tone of the exchange often is, we do scrutinize it, because if it's not transactional, if it departs from sort of that expectation of, you know, the tit for tat negotiation, there's a lot of useful information in that and a lot of interesting stuff to be garnered. So there, we've had some weird exchanges with individuals who seem very, very savvy, very knowledgeable, either on the tech side or the legal side, really structured, very, very, you know, we have, over the years, I've heard at least once or twice jokes about how some of these people talking to us would be great associates. They're just very, very clear communicators. So there's some interesting stuff to be learned there, although it's limited, obviously, in value if you can't truly identify the people.
Yeah, you can't hire them as associates if you can't check up on their clerkships and stuff if they don't identify themselves.
Although maybe it's a good strategy, Ben. Maybe we should be asking for resumes. It's not a bad, idea.
I want to ask you about some other aspects of the culture of these gangs. But before I do, I would just be a dilatory, it would be, you know, terrible of me to let you go without asking you what the weirdest thing that has ever happened in an exchange with a ransomware bad actor is. What's the strangest scenario that's arisen?
Yeah, I'm going to say this in really abstract terms, but there was one quick turn scenario we had where we had reason to believe that our client was victimized, and dug into it as diligently as we could. It turns out it was essentially a mistake. And at the end of that scenario, the threat actor was like, well, I really liked working with you guys. If you want to give me access to your company, then we could work together. We work really well together. And we were, of course,
the threat actor was asking you to get them into the actor so that they could attack it and then you'd get a cut.
Well, like, I mean, apparently the relationship was really good, right? Like all of the signals in the conversation were positive. It was funny because now that I've described the team that's assembled, right, on the other side of this activity, you know that this transcript's coming through and it's being seen by a team of negotiators. It's being seen by a team of lawyers outside. It's being seen by a team of in-house lawyers, as well as probably key business people.
It's not a person.
It's not one person. And this is actually, it's a lesson or a learning point that I've heard others sort of repeat, which is this is part of the reason that, like, you try to keep this information close hold in case this is useful to anyone, is you don't actually want to end up in the situation where someone at your company decides to unilaterally communicate with these threat actors. So sometimes ransom notes, right, are just left on a system. They'll be, you know, they'll pop up as .txts, or I've heard of some of them being printed out on printers and things like that. And so someone could say, I could get in touch with this person and start negotiating on their own. And part of the reason the infrastructure around this response is so close hold and structured, and of course, when we lead investigations, they're privileged and managed very tightly that way. That's key, right? Because when you see something like that, you suddenly realize, like, whoa, whoa, this actually happened. Someone was saying, like, you know, we have a really good working relationship. What else could we do? Should,
why don't you join our team? All right. So a few for people who, after listening to this, are inclined to be freaked out and climb under the couch. If you get a ransom note with a dollar figure, that is presumably some multiple of what you're actually likely to pay.
Yes.
So like if they say 100 Bitcoin, it doesn't really mean 100. It's a, we're in the bazaar and you're going to negotiate a price. In your experience, what's the average discount? So when people get their ransom notes, you know, what percentage of that is actually coming out of their pockets? And what percent should they say, no, that's just the opening bid?
Yeah, this, so this varies dramatically, like dramatically, depending on the gang. Some gangs, I have seen stats that some gangs will decrease by 70% sometimes. So it's not like a de minimis type of thing. So it depends on the gang. It also depends on what data they have. Like sometimes they don't know what they have. And so they're like willing to go down because you're one of many that they've hit. Right. So they've like put their feelers out for a while. If, you know, if they're doing, if they're just purely cyber extorting
you. If they're doing a volume business, then you may not be that important to them.
Exactly. Exactly. So even if you know what they have, they may not know what you have. And they'll go down pretty far. The price is almost certainly a starting point, and your ransomware negotiator will be able to tell you what they're seeing pattern wise across these gangs to get you an estimate of how far down they'll go. It could also be that they don't, but I mean, I've been in at least one scenario where they didn't budge. And when they got frustrated, wow, they raised the price, which ultimately, like, that was sort of not salient to our considerations at the time, but like that was a weird one. I wish that I could tell you that there are meaningful patterns for these criminals and that they operated in a predictable way.
Yeah, it'd be good to know just what the going price is, but it sounds like it's pretty, there's like not a lot of cost transparency here.
Yeah, sorry. It's not what it says on the tin.
Right.
And then of course, right, there are lots of great companies out there that aggregate statistics about reported incidents and reported payments or payments that have become public information. Then there's all the information that's not out there about what's been paid and the magnitude of those payments. You know, you can always sort of see patterns over time, but it's really hard to know what's going on in the background, unfortunately.
Who is the biggest, baddest ransomware gang out there? The threat actor who, when you hear their name, you're like, oh, this is going to be a tough one. They're pros.
I mean, they're all pros and they're all not pros. That's the unfortunate thing. I would say some recent gangs that have been in the news for this type of behavior, generally Scattered Spider has been on the lips of a lot of people recently as a very complicated gang to deal with. They were, again, this is in reporting. They were the gang who the MGM attack was attributed to, I think, last year. And they're just very difficult and complicated. Lockbit is being surprisingly resilient. Like there was the huge takedown of the Lockbit infrastructure earlier this year, and they seem to have bounced back. And so that's something to keep an eye on. I will say the flavors of if you are in this business or if you are worried about this or if you feel like you've suddenly been attacked and you know it and you need to find out more, it's important to get intel from your vendor or from whoever, from law enforcement, about the attitudes of these gangs, because they can, when you say big, bad, and scary, I think knowing what that means is important. So some of them are just going to be tough. Right. Like either they got into your system in a really clever way or they got a lot of data and they're just going to be tough negotiators. But that's business.
Or your lawyer last time decided they had a great working relationship with them.
Which does not happen, did not happen, will not happen. But some are personal. Like some of them will threaten to find your family members and harass them. Some of them do that. Some gangs have a reputation for swatting. And so in those scenarios, I feel the need to be specific about these dangers, because when you say big and bad, like this is, that's truly big and bad.
Right.
In those scenarios, you know, coordination with law enforcement can be helpful, and that might not just be coordination with the federal government. That might be coordination with your local law enforcement, depending on how viable these swatting risks are. I wouldn't say I see that often, but I have seen it. So it has happened, or not swatting, but the threats of swatting and communicating with family members has happened in scenarios that I've seen. So it's not unheard of.
Last question. Why do all ransomware gangs have names that sound like they could be bands?
It's Black not Cat. True of
Lockbit, Spiders. What's the spider one?
Scattered Spider.
Scattered Spiders. That sounds like, but it's not true of like street gangs. Street gangs have, you know, names that sound like street gang names. But the ransomware gangs all seem to have names that sound like they wanted to be garage bands, and they sort of graduated to robbing people.
So first of all, this is more of a sociologist question than a question for a lawyer, but I will share speculation.
Yeah, that's what we're going for.
First of all, them being garage bands that graduated to robbing people doesn't sound crazy. Doesn't sound unusual. Not every gang has one name, right? So some of these names are attributable to how they represent themselves, and some names come from other parties. I haven't seen any patterns. I will say I struggle with them though sometimes. So there was one gang we dealt with, which I think everyone dealt with at some point in time because it was pretty prolific. It was R Evil, and it's spelled R-E-V-I-L.
And yeah, but some people pronounce it Revil.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Which is brings up the whole Revils wobble, but they don't fall down problem.
That one. But I will say we spent a significant amount of time amongst ourselves deciding how to say it.
And you guys decided are evil?
Yeah, there was a camp on the Revil side. People thought Revil, and I was like, Revil. That can't be what they meant.
No, I think they must have been going for Revil. But who knows? I yield to your superior knowledge of this subject. Shannon Tagawa Mercer, don't be a stranger. Come back to Lawfare early and often in writing and in podcasting. You're a great American, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's great to be back. Good to talk to you too.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was me. I recorded it myself. I hit record and then I hit stop. All of which does not change the fact that you should become a material supporter of Lawfare so that we can bring you more cool stuff like this. Do it at lawfaremedia.org/support. The Lawfare podcast is edited by the estimable Jen Patia. Our music is performed by the equally estimable Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.